I definitely always had hoped that I could have the experience of raising a child and having a son or daughter. And it just so happened for me a little later in life than I imagined it would. And that was certainly due to choices I made. But at the time, you make decisions about where you are in your career and, you know, how much you want to change to have that be the thing that's going to happen in your life. And, you know, in some ways I wish I had started earlier, but in other ways, I think I wouldn't have probably pursued my career to such a strong degree if I had done it earlier, or I would have, it would have been difficult. I mean, I'm, you know, like it's hard, I think, managing your time and raising a child at the same time.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with three-time Grammy nominee, Justin Roberts. For nearly 20 years, Justin has created the soundtrack to families' lives, helping kids navigate the joys and sorrows of growing up while allowing parents to remember their own childhoods. Along with his band, the Not Ready for Naptime Players, Justin has traveled the globe from Hong Kong to New York and Miami to Seattle. His songs are the kind of get-stuck-in-your-head pop nuggets that draw more comparisons to Elvis Costello, Fountains of Wayne, and Paul Simon than any simple nursery rhymes. Justin is truly one of the all-stars of the indie family music scene. In addition to his recordings, Justin is also the author of two acclaimed picture books, The Smallest Girl in the Smallest Grade and The Great Henry Hoppendower. Justin is dad to his 1.5-year-old son. In this episode, Justin talks about becoming a happy, proud, but utterly exhausted father at 50, and how he found magic in even the darkest days of those first sleep-deprived months. He shares the advantages and struggles that come when both parents are full-time professional musicians. He's married to the lovely Anna Steinhoff, a talented Baroque cellist. And we talk about where he found the confidence to make a life creating kids' music and why that particular genre is so easy to dismiss but provides him the greatest creative freedom. Justin's latest album, Wild Life, is the most personal and intimate to date. It comes out later this month.
Yeah, it's been a little while since we were first chatting about this project. What's new? Anything big happen in between those two conversations?
Yeah, I'm almost finished with the record that I'm making. It's all mixed and it's going to the mastering plant and I'm handling the design of the booklet and all that kind of stuff and just getting the distributor release stuff put together, which is always a lot of crossing T's and dotting I's.
Sure. Well, congrats. I know that that's a big deal, getting that out the door.
Yeah, exactly. It's this record that I didn't really think I was ever going to make. I just was writing songs that I just didn't think I would put them into the world. And then I had enough of them and I thought, okay, maybe I'll make this record. I hope someone else cares about it. But it's a very personal record. I started writing it pretty much the moment we found out that Anna was pregnant. And I wrote it through Eli being born and after that. And so it's all about that process and sort of the expectations and the worries and all the things that go along with having a kid, but maybe more about parenthood than it is about childhood.
Hmm. So how would you characterize it against your other projects people might be familiar with?
I mean, I think it's closest to Lullaby, which, you know, Lullaby is kind of a mood record and most of the instrumentation is members from the Chicago Symphony and it's kind of a chamber music record, but it has one mood through the whole thing. Even though there's some variety. So I would say it's similar to that because there isn't like any all out rock. It's pretty low key and it's a lot of ballads and that sort of thing. But I don't think it's really like anything else I've made because Lullaby still had the theme of being a lullaby nighttime record. And this one is more just about the experiences I was going through. And I think that maybe it's a little more personal than most of the records I've made, even though all of my songs come from that place of exploring my own psyche and my own childhood. I think this one was about a specific time and place in a way that the others aren't.
Hmm. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my wife likes it. I don't know if that means anything. That's like,
yeah, well,
she's the only one who's heard it. She's all over it too, which part of what was really cool is my producer, Liam Davis, who I've been working with forever, has done all of my records. you know, he heard these songs and he kind of knew what it was about. So when we got into the studio, he ended up putting my wife, who's a cellist, across from me, and she and I were doing the basic tracks with our drummer. Gerald was in a separate room, either keeping time or playing percussion or playing drums, but we did all the basic tracks kind of across from each other, which was sort of intense because it's what the album's about. And I think it was a smart move on many levels.
I love that. That's really beautiful. It's a document, a record of this crazy thing called parenthood.
You know, I think about my own parents telling me the story of the day I was born, you know, and that gets retold every time they call me on my birthday. you know, the moments going to the hospital and all of those things. And I think, like, in this way, it's like even a bigger document for Eli when he's older to know what it was like before he came and after and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's amazing. It'd be great if we all got that little time capsule.
Yeah, totally.
Well, I want to definitely talk more about your body of work and projects and things like that. But you mentioned getting a call on your birthday from your folks and that reminder of how you came into the world. I'm curious to know more about your relationship with your own dad or other father figures you had who may have influenced your pursuit of music or creative exploration. What's the relationship like with your dad?
Maybe that's a good place to start, is that story that they always tell about the day I was born, which I was born at the end of the 60s. And at the time, there were still a lot of rules about fathers being in the room during delivery. It was just starting to change, I guess. And they actually searched out a hospital that would allow him to be in the room, which I think, you know, at the time maybe was more modern than it seems now. But that part of it is pretty meaningful to me because I think that it gave me the feeling that my dad was interested in being part of my childhood and upbringing, even though in a lot of traditional ways, he was the working father that was leaving early in the morning and coming home later at night. And my mother raised me. My memories of my father are that when he would come home, he would instantly get on the floor and put my brother and I up on his feet and fly us around the living room and, you know, had very physical relationship that was very loving with my dad, which was an awesome thing. But, you know, reflecting with him in adult life, he's sort of has a level of guilt about not being there as much as a father as he would have liked to.
That's interesting. Why do you think there's a difference there in how he feels about it and what you experienced?
You know, I don't know exactly, but I talk to him sometimes about his siblings and their experience of their father. And they all have very different ideas of how engaged he was with them. Some of them feel like he was totally distant and not there. And my dad's impression was that he was a very loving father and, you know, was very close. And so I think about things that might have influenced the way that I see the world from childhood experiences. And some of them I don't think are like intentionally bad things my parents did, but things that affected the way that I see the world in a way that they weren't doing out of maliciousness. But, you know, sometimes there are moments where that leaves a profound impact on you about how the world is and how you react to people that love you. So I think my memory of it is just a very positive experience, even though he wasn't around for most of the time that I was awake during the day on the weekends and when he would get home at night. I just remember him instantly being around us and playing with us and being a part of our little world that we were creating. And then you also asked about music, and I think both my parents would claim to not have any musical talent and not know where my love of music came from, but my dad is a huge fan of music. And I think I grew up watching him love music when we would listen to it. You know, he would play air keyboards and, you know, act like he was singing along to whatever the music was. And it was a lot of early rock and roll. And he's a fan of traditional country music, which at the time I didn't care for. And now I love things like Buddy Holly and stuff like that was played around the house. And the enjoyment that he took in listening to music was something that I definitely remember witnessing as a child and then maybe being embarrassed of as I got to be older, you know, just watching him be silly. But that Buddy Holly music, for one reason or another, when I'm sound checking a concert, I always play a Buddy Holly song to warm up my voice and get the sound the way I want it. And I attribute that a lot to having learned to love that music through my father. I would hear stories about the first time he saw, I don't know, Waylon Jennings or whoever he was telling me about at the time. And just the concerts he would go to, you know, back when radio was big and they would bring in a whole group of artists and he would go to these shows and see Hank Williams and various people. And I think that was an influence on me. And I found out later the reason they chose my name is my dad thought it would look good up in lights at the Grand Ole Opry. So like, I think he had an idea that I would be a musician for some reason. You know, I've never played the Grand Ole Opry, but they have come to see me at places where my name has been on the marquee. And I think that's been something that he's been really proud of.
And so are you listening to vinyl at home as a kid? Is that like where the music is coming into the house?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only at home, but at the time I was in preschool, you know, they had a record player in the preschool and I would bring my own albums into preschool and listen to them. And it was, I particularly remember the soundtrack to Fantasia. I really loved that. And I really liked Oliver, the musical, for whatever reason. I would bring records into preschool and listen to them. And at one point, my preschool teacher took my mom aside and said, "We're a little worried about Justin. He never talks to the other kids. He just sits in front of the record player and listens to music." And I still do that now. I find myself kind of isolated off listening to a new album and just engaged in it and able to block out everything else. Yeah, music always kind of hit me that way.
So you exhibited these tendencies early on, clearly, you know, a love for music and an interest in listening.
Yeah, and I think it came as a surprise in some ways to my parents, even though, you know, my dad had this hidden intention of me playing at the Grand Ole Opry. I remember being in elementary school and the community playhouse in Des Moines did Oliver and we went and saw it. And afterwards I said to my mom, "I would have liked to have tried out for that part." And she's like, "What? You would want to sing?" Like she didn't even have any sense that I would want to do that. Even though, you know, I'd taken piano lessons and done a few things. I don't think they thought that I wanted to be on stage singing. So there was this kind of variety show event happening and there were auditions for a children's chorus and some solos. And I ended up trying out for that and getting the solo in the show performed in front of a couple thousand people at the Performing Arts Center when I was in fifth grade or something like that. And then they were kind of aware that that was what I wanted to do. And I went from there to playing in bands in high school and college and getting into this strange career of making kids' music.
Yeah. You went to seminary?
I went to Divinity School at the University of Chicago.
Divinity School.
For graduate school, which was an MA. So it's like a religious studies program. And this was after playing in a band for 5 years in Minneapolis. And I'd always thought of maybe being a religion professor. And so I went back to school for that. And I did the master's, but not the PhD. And it was around the same time that I made a kids record right before I left for grad school. And the kids record kind of took off. And then I did the 2 years at the master's, but I decided not to apply for the PhD, partly because the job market looked pretty poor, to say the least, for religion professors. And I just was like, I don't want to end up somewhere I don't want to live. I like Chicago a lot. I'd rather stay here. And a lot more people are asking for me to play them kids' songs than they are asking me to write papers on esoteric topics.
That's fascinating. These just feel like very different paths. Why? What was, tell me more about those, or like help me understand the sequence of events there.
I think even from high school, I'd always wanted to be a philosophy major. I don't know why, but like I started reading philosophy when I was in high school. And so I was a philosophy major at Kenyon, but while I was there, I took some religion courses and there was a amazing professor named Donald Rogan who taught a bunch of incredible classes, things like readings of Job and agnosticism and unbelief and all these various topics where you would read novels and read philosophical texts and have discussions with 10 people around a table. And I love that so much that I ended up switching my major to philosophy of religion and took a bunch of classes with him and Di Pasquale, who was a philosophy professor there as well. And I'd always kept it in the back of my mind when I went off to pursue music with my band from college, which we were called Pimentos for Gus. I don't know why we didn't make it really big, but with a name like that. But we did tour around the Midwest and we put out some records and we had a great time for those 5 years. You know, when that started winding down and we were contemplating what our next move was, I was like, well, I've always thought of wanting to be a professor. So I think I'm going to go back to grad school. And started off in the philosophy of religion at University of Chicago. I was doing like Buddhism and Christianity comparative religion, and I realized I had to start with Sanskrit and then take Pali, and then I had to learn Hebrew and Greek. And in the middle of that, I was like reading the books that people were writing about philosophy of religion and in Buddhism. And it was like one verb that they'd spend 100 pages on talking about the verb tense. And I was like, yeah, this isn't really what I wanted to do. I don't know. Like, yeah. So I started taking theology classes at University of Chicago, and those were amazing and really profound and mind-blowing. But you know, it was around that time that I was juggling the ideas of what I wanted to do. And I had a lot of people, even some of the professors at University of Chicago were like, the stuff you're doing in children's music is really unique and you should do this. And so I guess when you have your professors telling you that, you think maybe you're not set and really ready for doing the long haul of a PhD in endless jobs.
Life search. In academia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Martin Marty, who's a very well-known Lutheran theologian and professor at University of Chicago, heard me both perform some of my kids' music, but I also wrote a bunch of songs for the Lutheran Church based on biblical stories that a friend of mine had gone to work for Augsburg Fortress, which is a publishing company in Minneapolis that's part of the Lutheran Church. And she was hiring kind of her friends that were indie musicians to write songs for curriculum. And I started doing that. And I'd played some of those songs at a Wednesday lunch, which is where they normally have speakers at the Divinity School. But they asked me to do it at one point, and I played a bunch of those songs and some of my kids' songs. And Martin Marty came up to me afterwards and was like, I love that. This is great. He's like, what are you doing here? So like, that was one of the things where I was like, what am I doing here? Maybe this is not the place for me.
And were your parents following along in this kind of back and forth between music and theology? And
yeah, they were. To make it even more complicated, it's always hard to tell your story, but like when I was in graduate school, I took a job as a network administrator at a consulting firm downtown because obviously it paid much better than the student jobs you could get on campus. After I graduated, I kept that job for a year or two while I tried to rebuild my finances from having been in graduate school. And then there came a moment where I was like, okay, I'm going to make another kids record and I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to book my own tour, and I'm going to try to figure out how to make a living in music because I don't want music to be my hobby. I either want to like have it be a career or I'll find a career that I love to do and do that instead. So I remember calling my parents up, and I had a good paying job with benefits. And I was like, I'm going to quit my job and get in my car and drive and play music for children. And I think they thought maybe it was a crazy idea, but they were super supportive. They were like, you should do what you want to do. You might as well take the risk. If it doesn't work out, you can always do something else. I know not every parent says that when you're like, I'm going to pursue a career in something that's really hard to make a living at. I had had some experience booking tours and things like that with the indie band that I played with in Minneapolis. And so it wasn't that much of a stretch for me to just start cold calling places and figuring out venues that would do kid shows. And, you know, I started doing concerts at Borders Books when it was still around and find little festivals in various parts of the country and call them up and say, hey, I want to play a kid show. And, you know, we'd book little tours. And then things started to blossom from there. And I found other kids musicians at the same time who were, you know, doing this kind of indie kids music. There are people like Dan Zanes in New York. And Dan was like, there's a Goodwill in Cambridge that does funk shows in the basement. And I did a kid show there last month. You should call them up and see if they'll do another kid show. And so I call this guy and he's like, oh yeah, we'll do a kid show in the basement of the Goodwill. And so, you know, I went out to Cambridge and played a show out there and a bunch of people showed up and started blossoming from there.
What gave you the confidence? What was the tipping point where you said, like, enough of this, I need to go all in on this music thing?
A lot of it came from my brother. He went to Northwestern. He graduated and took a job at a bank in North Carolina, like right out of college. And, you know, the bank was like, well, here's where you can buy your suits and here's where you have to go to church. And after about, I don't know, a month down there, my brother was like, this is not for me. And he like left his job. You know, it was a great paying job that he'd gotten. And he moved back to Chicago and started booking bands and comedy groups and being a manager. And he went on a road trip around the country and ended up in LA and saw a friend of his. And his friend was like, you should move to LA. And I have this job in production and I'm quitting and you should take it. And he moved out to LA and started working in production for a film company and worked his way up there. And then he was like, I'm not happy with what I'm doing. I want to be a manager. And he quit his job and started apprenticing at a management company. And then he quit that and started his own company. So I saw him do this real heavy risk taking over and over. And I think that gave me the confidence to try it. I think just watching somebody do something that seemed like economically a questionable choice, but then succeeding in it because he was just gung-ho about it. And that is the kind of person my brother is in general. And I wouldn't say I'm like that, but I think it just gave me the confidence to try it because I knew that I had to do something career-wise that gave my life meaning, that was really important to me. And I think that was part of the reason why when the kids' music thing popped up, I thought, well, I love music. And if there's a way I can make a career out of it, I'd love to do it. And so I just took the leap. And I thought at the time, I mean, this was when IT jobs like were just calling me constantly to give me a job paying twice as much as what I was making because they were just in need of people and everything hadn't crashed yet. So I also thought, well, if after a year or so it doesn't work, I'll just go back into IT.
And what, why kids music?
You know, I don't know, but when I was in Minneapolis playing in the band, the very first job I took was as a preschool teacher. And I think the reason I took that was because at the end of college, I had volunteered at a co-op nursery school with a friend of mine. And I just was like, oh my God, four-year-olds are hilarious and they're really interesting. And I found myself like thinking, well, I want a job that has meaning. And I thought like working with kids could be really cool. I found out, you know, it pays terribly. And it's really difficult to be playing shows at night at rock clubs and then get up in the morning and work with 3 and 4 year olds. But I chose it just because I thought it would be a meaningful thing to do. And I loved it. And I loved the questions that kids ask. And I started playing music with kids in the classroom. And instead of playing Itsy Bitsy Spider and things like that, I would play, you know, a song by Sam Cooke, like Cupid or something like that. And they loved it and they would sing along and I would play a Ramones song, you know, as long as the lyrics were appropriate, and they loved that. And so I started writing songs for kids and they were responding to the stuff I was writing. And I realized that I could write sort of in any genre as long as it spoke to concerns that a kid would have. And I think one of the big lessons I learned in teaching preschool was I played this song called Giraffe Nightingale that was a song that my band Pimentos Fregus performed for adults, but it was kind of a little fable about two animals. So I thought, well, the animal part will work with kids, but it's a bunch of verses with no catchy chorus and no repeated lyrics or anything like that. So I thought maybe they're going to be bored, but instead they requested it the next day. And then every time we had music, they would always request that song. And eventually they learned all the lyrics and we had an open house and these four-year-olds sang every lyric to this song. And I was like, kids can really take in anything you give them. You don't have to give them really simple, repetitive things. It can be that, and they do like that, but you can also tell them a good story and they'll be engaged. And I think that was the beginning of me realizing the breadth of what you can do within children's music. And in some ways, it gave me a lot more freedom than what I could do being a grown-up musician playing in rock clubs.
Say more about that freedom. Why is that?
I mean, there's obviously like the potential for silliness in writing for kids. And I mean, there is for writing for adults too, but I just don't think I tended to do that as much. I mean, then again, my band was called Pimentos Fregus, so maybe that doesn't make any sense. But the songs that I wrote in the group tended to be more on the serious side. And then Mike Hallenbeck, who's an amazing songwriter, was writing a lot more of our really fun stuff that made our name make sense. But I think in writing children's music, I felt a certain freedom and I was like, I can write a ska song or I can write a punk rock song and anything that speaks to a child in some way I can do. And I think it just opened a part of me that I hadn't really explored before. And I think I started finding this freedom in songwriting that I hadn't found in writing for adults only.
There's a pinpointed accuracy in capturing these childhood moments that I'm always struck by when I listen to your music. Like there's descriptions and settings and little nuances that are so spot on to a moment in time, or, you know, to a hallway in a school, to a doctor's visit, to these things that, and I find myself asking, like, if you don't have regular exposure, like through your own children, like how are you able to nail those moments or conjure them back from, you know, 40 years ago when you were a kid?
I think that there is like this really vivid memory of childhood for me that maybe is unique, that a lot of that stuff stuck with me more than somebody that I met 2 years ago or something. So I think often when I'm writing a song about something, these images appear in my head and, you know, I'm thinking about like Big Field Trip from Pop Fly that has a line about counting double time to 10 at the drinking fountain. Cause I remember the person behind you had to always count to 10. And if it was a friend of yours, they'd count really slowly. But if it was somebody that didn't like you, they would count quickly and you wouldn't get as long of a drink. And or the person really wanted to drink, so they would like speed it up so that they could get to the drinking fountain. And like things like that just occur to me when I'm thinking about like, what was it like on a field trip? I was for the longest time trying to write a song about Halloween, and I'm not really a huge fan of Halloween. I know that's not popular with a lot of people, but I have some good memories of like walking out in the fall in Iowa and going trick-or-treating. But the thing that suddenly occurred to me that made the song work is I remembered being at home with my brother and putting our treasures on the floor, and he started alphabetizing his candy. And I just remember that as being this really specific thing of like how much you treasure the candy that you get back from trick-or-treating and how it's all about that. And so instead of writing a really creepy song about ghosts and goblins, I wrote this song that's very anthemic about trying to get as much candy as possible and hope it lasts till the spring and that sort of thing. And that image occurs in the song. And I think that was kind of the beginning of me figuring out how to write a song that meant something to me, but would speak to kids as well. A lot of my stuff for me, it has to like hit me in the heart as an adult. So how does a song about Halloween do that for me? It's like that song for me is about like getting through the winter and like, you know, storing up the things that make you able to survive through that. You know, I've got so much candy in this bag. It's going to last until November, December, January, February, March, or April. And you know, it goes on like that, like the idea of making it through that. And to me, that speaks to me as an adult, even on a metaphorical level. So I think that sort of thing has to be happening for me, even if other people don't experience the song that way. It makes it have heart, which is what I care about. Mm-hmm.
I feel like the genre can be dismissed. Like there's something about kids' music that's like, oh, well, it must be easier to make because, you know, the song structures are simpler. I don't know if that's true, but I just feel like when you put it up against any other genre, it's like, oh, it's simple song structure. It's highly repetitive, or it's Baby Shark, or it's these sort of like disposable kind of songs. Not all of it, obviously.
Yeah,
but
no, I totally agree. I think much of it is dismissed. But for good reason. I think part of the reason I started singing different songs with kids than the stuff that was around at the time was there is a lot of it that's horrible. I didn't want to listen to it. I don't like really saccharine, preachy things for children. I don't like them for adults. Like I don't want to listen to something that's telling me what to do or what to think. I want to be told a story. I want to be moved emotionally. I want to get inside a character's head. So for me, it was just initially just kind of a selfish thing where I was like, okay, I'll write some songs for these preschoolers, but I'm going to write songs that I like, that sound like music I would listen to and have intelligent lyrics and see what they make of it. And it wasn't like, I wonder what kids would like. I bet they would like this. It was often, I don't know if kids will like this, but here it is and let's see what happens. And that's kind of the way I've done everything. And, you know, there've been times throughout the years where I've record a song and I'm like, oh, this is definitely only for the parents. Kids aren't going to want to listen to this. Like there's a song called Never Getting Lost off Jungle Gym that's about a kid getting lost at the mall. I have a memory of that happening to me at one point, so I can certainly relate to that idea. But I wrote that song thinking, okay, you know, the mom or dad driving in the minivan will probably find this song moving, but I doubt a kid will like it. And I was out in Seattle at one point and a mother came up to me and said, oh, my son's favorite song is Never Getting Lost. And I'm like, oh, wow. And he was like 3 years old. And I was like, has he ever been lost before? And she's like, no, but he's really concerned about people who get lost. Just like, it's amazing. Like a 3-year-old, that is the thing that's going through their head, is like, oh, I want to help them. Like,
that's so sweet.
It's so amazing. Like, and that they listen to the song and get that out of it. And you know, there's another song I wrote about a friend's mother who passed away that is called Sandcastle. And once again, death is not necessarily the most popular. You know, people do try to do it, but it's not like the first thing people think of when they're going to write a song for children. And I wrote it more for my adult friend whose mother passed away than I did for kids. But I told it in the story of a father and son going and building a sandcastle and watching it get washed away. And this 9-year-old girl, I think it was maybe in LA or something, came up to me and that was her favorite song. And I was like, what do you like about it? And it's like, well, in the song you talk about someone being beautiful and bold, and that's me. You know, so people pick out what they do out of art and find themselves in it. And I think that's the thing about writing for kids, is you don't have expectations about what they're going to like. Or when you start to do that, then you pander to them and you make bad music, I think. And if you're just trying to make something that is meaningful to you and tells a good story, then you bring along a whole bunch of other people and you find grandparents relating to what you write about as much as a three-year-old.
That's right. Maybe in the way that it's easy to write off children's music, it's sort of easy to write off children's critical assessment of things. Like, oh, they're just kids. They'll like anything, you know? If it's got a fun beat, you know, they're not going to think about it too hard. But you just shared all of these instances where kids exhibited a real sense of quality music or important subject matter or saw themselves in the music in a way that you never intended. And I think that's important to not underestimate children's judgment of things.
Yeah, it's not like we suddenly get to an age where we have emotional depth. You have emotional depth from the moment that you're born. Like, I don't think you somehow get that when you reach a certain age. I think the capacity for emotional depth is there from the beginning. And kids go through experiences that are traumatic for real. And sometimes they're average growing things, but nonetheless, you experience them in that kind of heavy way. And I think one of the things I've also found myself doing in writing kids' music is sort of trying to erase that line between childhood experience and adult experience. And like an example of that is Giant Size Butterflies. That's a song about a first day of school, and it's about the nerves that go into that. But in the course of the song, the mother in the song says, "I remember the day you were born and your father and I felt that way." Like, everybody has that first day experience, whether it's a new job or any kind of new experience, you feel that sense of, I don't know if I can do this. And finding that common ground, I think, is cool. And I always find that in talking to kids when I was working with them at a preschool or since then, is like when you talk to them like you talk to another adult and you explain things to them, they get a lot out of it. And it doesn't have to be this kind of like, I'm the know-it-all adult figure and you are the child. I mean, there are times where that's helpful and needed, but I also think there's a commonality between us that isn't like children or aliens to adults, which I think sometimes people just think childhood is this separate little bubble that isn't attached to the rest of life. Mm.
Yeah, I can't stand dumbing things down or just baby talk in general. Like, there's just something about that I'm like, no, these little beings are more than we know.
Well, the profound things that come out of them is just amazing. Like, that's the best part of performing sometimes, is that it's not this one-sided experience. There was this one time where I was playing this song, thought it was a monster, about being afraid of the dark. And I'm like, has anyone out there ever been afraid of the dark? And usually people just raise their hand. But this girl stood up in the middle of the concert and started talking. And she said, well, I was afraid of the dark, but then my mom gave me this magic pillow. And she went on and told this whole story about this magic pillow for like, I think, 2 minutes straight. And the audience was like, you could have heard a pin drop. And she finished it and she sat down and people just broke into spontaneous applause.
You know, it's like, awesome.
I don't know. There's so much going on inside the mind of a child.
You know, so you never had early childhood development training or anything like that?
I didn't. I worked at this preschool. They somehow found enough credits in my philosophy classes to be an assistant teacher. But it was at a Montessori school, and I didn't know anything about Montessori when I got there. But I started reading her books just to get a sense of what was going on in the classrooms. And that had a pretty profound influence on me as well. It makes me think of one of the songs that I wrote when I was there, which ended up on my first record, is this song about the three little pigs. And while I was there, they had like a Disney version of that book, and I was reading it to the kids. And I was like, I hadn't really thought of the story since I was a kid. And I was reading it to them, and I was like, I hate this story. This is a terrible story. It's like telling kids to be afraid of things and to build a brick house and be a pig in a three-piece suit. And that's the hero of the story, is the one who blocks out his fears and like earns enough money to do that. And the two kind of loser characters in the story were like playing flute and frolicking in the fields. And I'm like, okay, those are obviously the artists that are like being devalued by this capitalist story that I'm telling to kids. So I rewrote the story like in the song, which is all about being in the moment and not letting your fears control your life. And you feel this great weight when you're influencing minds that only have so many images and things imprinted on them. And you're like, this is what we're going to feed them. This is a horrible story. This is about fear. And that's the opposite of what you should be teaching. There are moments like that where you just feel the weight of it and you want something better for those minds because they're waiting for any information that they can get to process. And they're unlimited in the way they see the world. And I think you start applying those walls and that's a sad thing. So you want to try to preserve what's so magical about the way that kids see the world.
You had mentioned that you always planned to have kids or a kid, but it never happened. And you talked about touring and, you know, a lifestyle as a musician that felt incongruent with parenting or family.
Yep.
And yet you had band members who are parents or fathers. So you saw examples of people managing it. And so
yes,
I'm curious.
And doing it well.
Yeah. I'm curious what those feelings were like making kids music, playing for kids and families, not having your own. And tell me more about that.
Well, I think it was, in a lot of ways, it was hard because I would see families together enjoying each other and being together and singing together and dads being silly and daughters, you know, punching their dad in the arm and things like that. And I love, you know, just watching families together in the little units that that would come to my shows. And, you know, then there was the other side of it, which was I was constantly being reminded of this by every journalist that would ever talk to me. Well, you don't have kids, so how do you write songs about kids? And I'm like thinking, like, having kids doesn't make you good at writing songs like at all. Like, so why is that the impression that that's going to be the thing that makes you good at writing children's music? I was recently talking to one of our babysitters who's got a really amazing perspective on things, and she doesn't have kids. And she's like, having kids doesn't make you good at taking care of kids. Like, it's a different skill. I think that's a similar thing. Like, I was always reminded of that. And I always thought, like, well, Bruce Springsteen writes songs about being in a union and he's not a coal miner. You know, it's like, it's that's you right. don't need that to be able to do it well. I think writing songs has a certain skill of storytelling and getting inside a character's head. But, you know, I did feel like even though I wrote plenty of songs that I still stand by now that are from a parent's perspective before I had kids, I still think they resonate and they get to the emotions that I'm feeling now. You know, I definitely always had hoped that I could have the experience of raising a child and having a son or daughter. And it just so happened for me a little later in life than I imagined it would. And that was certainly due to choices I made. But at the time, you make decisions about where you are in your career and, you know, how much you want to change to have that be the thing that's going to happen in your life. And, you know, in some ways I wish I had started earlier, but in other ways I think I wouldn't have probably pursued my career to such a strong degree if I had done it earlier, or I would have, it would have been difficult. I mean, you know, like it's hard, I think, managing your time and raising a child at the same time.
It is, no doubt. So thinking back to how that all started, what was it like when you found out you were having a kid?
My wife, Anna, and I decided we wanted to have kids. Even before we got married, we started trying and it didn't happen for a while. So there was a little bit of an element of, we'll wonder if this is really going to happen anyway, even if you do want it and you are open to the opportunity, doesn't mean it's going to. And so, you know, we were contemplating that and going to maybe look into seeing if there were things we could do to make it happen and that sort of thing. And then suddenly, right when we weren't trying, I think everyone says this, but like, you know, we found out that she was pregnant and it was amazing, but also like you almost don't believe it's true. And, you know, there's the time where you aren't really able to tell a lot of people because you want to wait until you're certain that everything is going okay. And that's kind of a magical time when you're keeping that secret between you and your spouse and maybe your parents and close family members. I don't know. I found that to be a really magical time. And I remember thinking a lot about this being inside, just this little universe inside the mother that is holding this very delicate thing in balance and part of her body and this being that's going to be a totally separate person from her and from me.
What gave you confidence at some point to say, okay, I think I'm ready to try to have kids? Like what lined up to make that more true or possible in your mind?
Well, after my first marriage, you know, I was single for a while and thinking, I don't know if this is going to happen. But I mean, that certainly was in my head while I was dating was I would still like to have kids. And so that certainly was a conversation that came up in general. So I think finding a partner that I felt like was the right person to go on this journey with was probably the biggest part of it. And once we'd found each other, I think it was pretty clear, even though it was a totally scary proposition, her being a full-time musician as well, to have kids and take this risk. But, you know, there's something about the confidence of a strong relationship where communication is good and you're like, let's throw a wrench in this. Let's see what we can, let's see if we can make it even more complicated. Things are going really well. There's something about the way that we communicate where I felt safe in taking a risk like this together and knew that we would somehow be able to communicate even with, you know, 3 hours of sleep a night in the beginning and all the chaos that happens. And it turned out to be true. I mean, it's not easy. It's as hard or harder than I imagined even like contemplating that to begin with. But it's also just the most magical thing, as everyone says. But like the thing that struck me the most, I think, was just the moment that Eli arrived. It was like this person that I didn't know, but like seemed fully formed and sort of his own being, like from the moment he came out. And I think like the traits that he shows as he's, you know, only aged a year so far, but like the things that people recognized in him from the first weeks of his birth have like turned out to remain. Like he's very intense and very like focused. And it's just amazing to me to see how much is formed in a person when they arrive. And I think you can obviously influence that or cause problems with that, with how their experience goes in the world and how much they're loved and all those things. But it's just kind of magical to like, oh, this person is their own person, like right away. You think it's half you and half your wife. No, it's like this other being. And like, it makes you feel like so unworthy in some ways, or like so disconnected from it, you know, in a way that you're like, wow, this is a unique person who is neither my wife nor I. And this will be fun to get to see who they are.
How have things changed in your creative practice? You mentioned your wife is also a musician.
Yep.
So you have two creative people who have, in some ways, a schedule that allows some freedom.
Yeah.
And then in other ways, demands on them that, you know, a 9-to-5 parent would never have. Can you tell me how you've adapted and ways that you're thinking about work now?
Yeah. I don't know that we fully adapted. It's an ongoing process. We've done our best to like balance each other's careers as much as we can. And the freedom is good because we've managed to, for the most part, just trade him off back and forth when either one of us has to be away. But we've had a lot of help from especially Anna's parents, who've just been amazing in terms of coming and visiting or going on trips with Anna occasionally when she's traveling, when I'm also traveling at the same time. I think a lot of it has been trying to, you know, look forward on our calendars and trying to figure out how we balance it with each other's careers and with taking care of Eli. And, you know, we've both decided, you know, at some point we're going to do some bits of daycare and obviously preschool and things like that. But we've really loved having him around and having him here while we both work from home. It makes working from home a lot harder, but we're getting all this time with him, which I think to us is worth the sacrifice of, you know, having our careers be maybe a little more at 70%, if I'm being generous, you know, in terms of the time, because we're getting all of these moments with him. And I think, you know, overall, we've made it work and we've both allowed each other the time that we need to prepare for things that we're doing. My wife obviously has to rehearse a lot for her career. And, you know, I'm trying to find times to write and record and do those sorts of things. So we try to balance it and say, I really need you this week, so I'm going to be at these rehearsals and I'll just be a full-time dad for a while. And then we switch off and is like, this is your week to do whatever you need to do work-wise. And it's somehow working, but it's difficult and it's not the same. I mean, we both think like, we used to have all this time. What did we do with it?
Like, you know, right?
It's like, what a luxury. Like, mm-hmm. Wow, we used to be able to sleep in.
Yeah, I know. Maris and I will play out these little fantasies about, you know, our old life every once in a while. And it's just enough to...
It was so easy.
Get us through. Yeah.
She's like, what do you want to do for dinner tonight? I don't know. Let's walk down the street and go out.
These were the hardest decisions we were making.
Yeah.
And so tell me a bit more about the new album, the records you're making now, how they reflect this new identity as a father, as a parent.
So when I found out that Anna was pregnant, My first thought was I need to write a new kids record as quickly as possible while I have the time. And I was planning to write an album for the band, make a big fun rock kids record like I've done in the past. And instead, I found myself writing these really small songs about all the stuff that was going through my head in terms of bringing a new life into the world and all the fears and expectations that you have. And I think as I was writing these songs, I wasn't like, okay, these are the songs I'm going to release. It was more like, this day I wrote this song, and you know, at the end of the day, I'd play it for my wife and she'd love it. But I was like, not thinking this is the record I want to make. This is just these songs I'm writing. I mean, the very first song I wrote, which was kind of like unlike anything I'd written before, was this song that's called When You First Let Go. And it begins with this line, the first thing I remember, I was moving back and forth in time with you. And it's this image of a child on a swing and the parent kind of pulling the seat back and letting the kid go. And it goes on to an image of learning how to ride a bike and that same kind of feeling of not knowing if your parents still running behind you or not. And then the third verse, which is probably a verse that no one would ever consider writing, I tried to write, you know, about like not remembering being inside the womb and like what that's like when you're connected to this other person and, you know, then you're left into the world. And there, I have this line, I knew nothing of the world below when you first let go. You know, so it's this kind of intense song, but I'm like thinking, I don't know who this is for, what this is about, but it's me thinking about my soon to be son or daughter coming into the world. And then the second song I wrote during that period was this song called Maybe She'll Have Curly Hair, which is this song about the expectations of what this person is going to be that comes in the world. And the funny thing about that song was I finished writing it and played it for Anna. And minutes later, the doctor called and said, we got the results back. Do you want to know, you know, if your kid is a boy or a girl? And it turned out to be a boy. And it was like, it's so funny because I'd just written a song about maybe she'll have curly hair, you know, expecting a daughter. But anyway, it kind of went from there. And I just kept writing songs about the day of his birth and songs about what it's like to be in the world and how glad that we are that you're here and things like that. And I just think I never really thought of making this into a record until I had all these songs. And then my wife was really saying, you got to release this. You know, these are some of the prettiest songs that I've ever heard that you've written. And it sort of all came together to me feeling, you know, sort of okay about putting this out. But I also feel like it's such a personal record and it's so, you know, I don't know, on paper, if I hear like somebody had a kid and they made a record about having a kid, that makes me want to throw up. So like, I don't think, I'm like, I don't want to hear that. So like, I don't know, but I do think the songs are strong and interesting and maybe not exactly what people would assume from that, at least altogether. And so, you know, ultimately I'm excited for people to hear it, but I'm also like maybe more nervous for people to hear it than anything else I've done because it is maybe more personal and more direct than I have been in the past.
And do you think you'll continue to write in that way with your son as a muse or as a influence?
I mean, I'm already seeing like the things that he's interested in and the ways that he's responding to the world. And I'm assume that those will continue to influence me and reminding me of things from childhood that I've forgotten or new ideas for things that are of concern to children that maybe slip my mind. So I think in some ways that will be an inspiration. I've so often relied on memory and friends' memories of childhood to come up with the ideas for the songs. And I'm sure that will continue to be the case, but having him nearby, you know, with knowing what kids say and questions they ask, I can't help but think that that will be an inspiration. I definitely think no matter what I do, the next thing I do is going to be an all-out rocking kind of experience. And I want to utilize the great band that I play with.
What does balance look like for you? Like, I know we're just kind of riffing on what the future holds, and now your son is one and maybe sleeping through the night a little bit more. And like, what's the ideal state with the two of you as parents and musicians and sometimes collaborators? Like, play that out. Like, it would be amazing if we got into this sort of rhythm, or I could see us finding this kind of balance.
I don't really know, because I think like with anything, we're making it up as we go along. But I'm assuming as he gets older, it will be both easier for, and maybe this isn't true at all, because everything else has been a surprise. But I have seen some musicians bring their kids on tour with various people helping. And as he gets a little older and is able to communicate more and is eating nothing but solid food and all of that, I feel like we'll probably travel as a family a little bit more, and we'll also go out on our own trips and be taking care of him at home when one or the other is out. But I do think it's just going to be more of a balance than before. I think before, you know, both of us just, we'd take every gig that came along and we'd do every project that came along. And I think now we're starting to like decide what really matters to us more. And that is a balance between, you know, having an amazing family life at home and earning a living and doing art and trying to do all of those things, because they all matter to us, and neither of us want to give up our artistic careers, but both of us feel like we don't want to give up the experiences at home either. So there's some kind of balance in there that is about finding that place. I think the song "Maybe She'll Have Curly Hair" is sort of, it goes into this metaphor about being on a ship and taking orders from people, and how maybe this new person will not be doing that. And there's a line like, maybe she'll just walk the plank, smiling at them as she sank, diving through the dolphins in the undertow, going all the places we're afraid to go. And there's this idea of like being more content in your life and not taking orders from other people, and sort of being in the moment, that, you know, is something I'm always striving for. So I think hopefully I'll find some balance that leads to a place like that. Maybe not that magical, but, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways, a child makes you reconsider all of the responsibilities and things that you agree to, in a way that you start to decide what you value and what is important. And it's always a balance between surviving and making a living and doing fantastic things, but also the moments you have as a family are so valuable that you want those as well. So how do you balance it all? I have no idea. I don't know where I went there, but
no, that's great. I think, you know, without regret, what advice do you have for the creative guy who's about to become a dad, or even if you could go back 5-10 years and talk to an earlier version of yourself, now that you've done it, right? And you took that risk and you started this family and you've got this amazing child. What would you say?
Everyone should have children when they're 20 years old. No, I feel like I would bounce back quicker from the exhaustion level than I do now.
No doubt.
But, you know, I would say if it's something that you feel deep in your heart, I mean, I know from listening to other podcasts that you've done, like some people have different experiences. Maybe some people are like, I never really wanted to have a kid, and then I met the right person and I suddenly felt like it was a possibility that I would want to go on that journey. And there are probably other people like me who've always thought they might have a kid, but the situation didn't present itself for various reasons. And, you know, I would say if it's something that you want to experience in your life, it's a mind-blowing experience on all levels, and totally reorients the way that you see the world and has amazing things that you'll discover through this experience. It's also extremely hard and will prevent you from doing a lot of things because of the new life that you have in the world. So I don't think it's an easy choice for anyone to make, but for me, it's so worth it. And my wife and I say this all the time. We're like, this is the hardest thing and it's so hard. And how do we keep our careers going, and how do we do this and how do we do that? But it's worth it, because look at this person we get to meet every day, and that in itself has made it a journey worth taking.
Last question. Does being a musician and an author and a writer, I know you have children's books too.
Yep.
Does that make you a better dad or a worse dad?
I mean, that's a good question. I think some of the elements for me for creating involve stealing time away from everybody else and being in a room by myself and singing nonsense syllables until it turns into a song, or jotting down stories and tearing them up and starting over again. So I think in some ways it's such a private practice that you have to remove yourself from the people you love sometimes to do it. So I think in some ways it makes it harder, but I think the element of music and storytelling that is such a part of everyone's life as human beings, you get to experience that with your kids. So, I mean, Eli and I are playing cello banjo together, you know, when we're having fun, or I'm reading him stories by other people that I love. And so I think being in that world makes me appreciate the time with him when I'm sharing those things with him, whether it be music or books or art on our walls or things like that.
Justin, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.